Okay, good afternoon, everyone. So I'm Charles Rice. I'm going to be teaching, this is 3330. Hopefully you're here for 3330 and not something else, or you don't mind being here for 3330. So I'm going to be teaching 3330 this semester along with Samira Khan, who's back there. As you may have seen on SIS and Lose List, there are two lecture sections of this course. Nominally, I'm teaching one and Samira's teaching the other. Practically speaking, I'll be teaching both sections some days and Samira will be teaching both sections some days, like Luther and I did last semester for 3330, if you've heard from people. And so to start off, 3330 is computer architecture. So we're going to be talking about how computers work. And we're going to go through all sorts of layers of abstraction that we use. We don't actually develop hardware in terms of gates, transistors, and registers, which some of you may have seen in a prior course, some of you may have not. But we build up these layers of abstraction. And you've seen some of these before in 2150. You've seen a little C and C++, certainly, the sort of how you actually program computers. You've seen some assembly, including some x86 assembly. Most of you have seen the 64-bit version, and that's what we'll be using in this course. And if you've only seen the 32-bit version, catching up is not too hard. We'll also be working with machine code. So you work with a very toyish machine code in 2150. We're going to have our own sort of fake machine code that's a bit less of a toy, called Y86. Talk about why we're using that and not real machine code later. And we'll also be looking at how we build processors. So we'll talk about how we implement this machine code. And that's why we care about having a machine code. You're going to implement something which you could turn into real hardware that deals with machine code, that actually runs the machine code. And that's most of the work in this course. So let's start out by talking about our choice of a higher level language. You note it says C up here. So we're using C in this course, not C++. And this course is really supposed to be about computer architecture. So why do we care about higher level language? It seems like we should just be doing everything in assembly. That's more realistic. And that's not what we're going to do. So the reason we're choosing C as our higher level language is that it's almost a subset of C++, so you basically already know it. We'll talk about some things in C that are different than C++ and some things in C that are also in C++ that you don't know over the next few lectures to help catch you up, and we'll have some assignments to make sure that you can actually write C. And the reason we're using in this course, even though our focus is on hardware, is that C has a fairly direct correspondence to assembly. So you can look at C code and create equivalent assembly code pretty straightforwardly. This is not so true for something like Python or Java, where there's often a lot more steps to creating reasonable assembly code. So this should help you understand how the machine works. If you see a C program, you can have an idea of how a machine might execute it, because you can look at the C program and think about what instructions that turns into, and when we talk about how processors work, what the processor is doing to run that code. And it's more convenient to deal with a little bit of C code than the much longer snippet of assembly that is also harder to read, doesn't have variable names. So we'll like working with C code. So I'll give you a caution. While we think this is good for understanding things and useful, this is not necessarily what you're going to experience with real compilers. So I say there's a direct correspondence. That means I can take C code and do something very straightforward to produce assembly. Your compiler may or may not do that. And sometimes your compiler won't do that. We'll talk about that in the coming lectures, but you should be aware of this. So you shouldn't assume that your C code will work like this direct correspondence, even though it's useful for talking about how hardware works. But in the real world, your C compiler might try to do something a lot more clever, something maybe faster. This is the big reason they do it, is that they want to make your code faster So they might do something that's not the most straightforward thing. That's not something we would do to understand how the hardware works. But this means that you might be surprised at what your C code turns into. This is just a warning. We're not going to talk about exactly how to tame compilers in this class. But you should be aware of it since, we have this supposedly useful abstraction. And that brings me to our sort of first ungraded homework in this class, which is to get a C compiler that works. And we need a little more than that. So as I'll mention later, we have a website which has the assignments. And your first task is to install a C environment. And we also want something which can compile programs in the programming language D, because there's a tool we'll use later in the semester that's written in D, not because you'll have to write D code. And your options are, you can use lab accounts and SSH. That's a very popular option. You can use Linux either natively on your own machine or in a VM. You can use an online IDE. These have all worked for people. You're going to need to do this preferably by the next lab. So I understand that you probably do not have lab Unix accounts yet. I'm informed you should get them over the weekend. That is a very common way to do this. And you should make sure that those work. And I would strongly recommend making sure that works before the first lab next Wednesday, or else you will probably not have a good time in lab. And please contact us if you it looks like the lab's coming and you're not going to have that working. So as I mentioned, the most common thing is lab machines, and that's our supported platform. But for most of the assignments, you can run it on your personal laptop, often not even using Linux. Like, a lot of people get away with using OS X or some Unix-like environment on Windows. But if you run into trouble, if you have some technical difficulties and you come to us, we're going to say SSH into the lab machines. We're not going to try to, probably not going to try to debug why things aren't working on Mac OS X for you. And for most assignments, you just need something Unix-like. So it doesn't matter exactly what you have. Like, a VM is fine. OS X is probably fine. There are a few assignments, and we'll warn you before them, where VMs are not a good idea, where you have to measure performance precisely, and VMs have different performance than real machines and mess that up. And so you probably want to SSH into the lab machines or use something native for that. We'll warn you when that comes, just so you know what you have to be able to use. So any questions about why we're using C and the environment you need to have available? OK, so let's move on to talk about assembly. So a lot of this course will deal with reading and writing assembly. And we'll be using basically 64-bit x86 assembly. And in theory, all of you know this. And you may notice that we have a day of assembly review on the schedule, so we don't actually believe that. But in theory, you all know this, and this should be review. We will be relying on you having seen things before. But we will go over assembly and talk about things that maybe were very much glossed over in 2150. And for most of the semester, we'll only be using a small piece of x86 64 assembly. So you won't need to know the whole thing, which is good, because a 64-bit x86 has like 1,000+ instructions. And we'll never ask you to memorize that many. But we're using a small subset because you need to implement it. And while it might be convenient to have lots of instructions for writing assembly, if you have to process assembly, having lots of instructions would not be something you'd enjoy. You'll be happier having about 13, which is what we'll have you implement. So a note about 32 versus 64-bit. So who here took 2150 and learned 32-bit x86? OK, so maybe like 15%? So you're going to have a little extra trouble. We don't think it's a big deal. So the biggest difference that you're going to notice is that 64-bit assembly has more registers and they're bigger. That's the biggest difference. The instructions are basically the same otherwise, as far as we're concerned. There are a few other differences, but they basically won't come up in this course. So that's what you need to know. And our textbook, fortunately, goes over assembly if you need a reference. So any questions about knowledge of assembly this course? We're gonna move on? Okay, so in that case, let's talk about machine code. So you notice I have listed Y86. So we're gonna use our textbook's machine code, and you should probably get a copy of this textbook if you don't have one, which is Y86-64. So for example, this is the encoding as hexadecimal numbers of this assembly snippet in that machine code. We'll go over later in the semester exactly how the machine code works, how you encode things, and it's what we're going to have you implement. And there's two reasons we're using this instead of real x86-64. So one is that we only care about a subset of instructions. So this encoding is only going to deal with a small number of instructions. It's not going to deal with all or even a substantial number of the x86, real x86 instructions. It's also going to be much, much simpler than the real x86 encoding. So Intel has a lot of history. So originally, x86 started with the 8086. The 8086 had eight 16-bit registers, four of which were general purpose, four of which were kind of special. And that's how it worked. And then they added 32-bit support on that. So they made the registers bigger, and they added something to the encoding to support operations on those bigger registers without breaking the 16-bit stuff. And then later on, they decided to add 64-bit onto this. And they did that without breaking the 32-bit stuff. So the x86 encoding has all this sort of complication because it's actually sort of backwards compatible with the older processors. It's not actually. You can't take a SIP program for the 8086 and run it in the 64-bit mode on a processor. It won't work, guaranteed. But the encodings are kept related, presumably because it makes implementing the processors easier. So a modern processor, like the one on my laptop, I can, in fact, if I change the processor to a special mode, run a 16-bit program written for the 8086 that is still supported because Intel really cares about backwards compatibility. And that sort of drives their instruction encoding. So it means it has all this complication to somehow add extra registers without changing how the old instructions are encoded. So it's really weird. Things are not in the place you'd expect. We don't want to use that encoding. So we're going to use a much simpler encoding made by our textbook. So some of you may remember that in 2150, as I recall from glancing over those slides, you have your own toy machine code called ICBM. People remember that? Yes? Okay. Yeah, or maybe you spelled wrong. I can't. Yes. I only glanced at the slides. So this is not going to be quite as simple as that. So one difference you'll see is that we're going to use a variable length encoding. Instructions are going to be between 1 and 10 bytes in our encoding, which is going to make the hardware a little more complicated, going to make encoding and reading a little more complicated, but it turns out to be pretty useful for an x86-like instruction set to do that. So that toy processor in 2150, you basically didn't have to ever choose registers. We're going to have a mostly full register set. Turns out Y86 is going to get rid of one of the registers x86 has, but that's still going to be 15 registers. So all your operations will act on one of those 15 registers, or two of them, and we'll have also full conditional jumps, so you'll have almost the conditional jumps that x86 supports, not quite, but most of them. And we'll have stack manipulation instructions. So that's much more complicated. Push and pop, that is, are much more complicated than probably anything you had in that toy processor in 2150. And these are all things you're going to implement in sort of simulated hardware later in the semester. So, questions about machine code? In that case, let's talk about this question mark box. So this is the hardware that implements the machine code. And that's what we're going to spend most of our semester on. Not the beginning, so you won't notice it right away. We're going to do that. And some of you may have this question of, why are you requiring me to take this course that's mostly about hardware? I just want to write my C programs. I don't care how all this stuff works. Why should I care how all this stuff works? Why are you wasting my time? That's a reasonable question. And there might even be a trend to places not to teach architecture because they don't see that stuff as valuable. So I think that this class will be useful to you even if you never expect to design hardware, you never expect to do programming in low-level languages like assembly. I think this class will still be useful to you in whatever you do programming-wise as a computer scientist, because there's reasons you want to understand how hardware really works. And we're going to touch on these, some of these pretty directly in this course, some of these just indirectly. So one is you want to understand program performance. And later on in the semester, we're going to have an assignment which is precisely about program performance. And knowing how the hardware works is going to be very important for understanding program performance. And so can anyone think of reasons why that would be the case? What's one reason why you'd want to know how the hardware works to understand program performance? It's the sort of simplest, yeah.
I mean, because it takes time for the electronics to improve. So
okay.
If you know how
far
it's going.
So knowing about how, about wires will tell you about how data has to move, yeah?
I mean, like, based on your hardware, you only have a certain amount of like, computing power. So like, for example, if you want to play some game, you can't put the settings to the highest that they can go given certain hardware.
Yeah, so you might want to understand hardware to understand how much computational power you should be getting is another way, one thing to think about. What are your limits? And as a programmer, you might care about that not because of what performance do you get when you set the settings to that. As a programmer, you might say, can I even target this performance on this hardware? That'd be a question you might want to answer. So does anyone have a model for, if you have a program, how do I tell how fast it is besides running it? So, anyone who has an answer? No? Okay. Yeah.
Like time complexities.
Time complexity, so that's one way. And so that's precisely what we're basically not going to be dealing with.
Right.
Time complexity is very important to performance, but we're going to talk about mostly other aspects of performance. Anything else? Yeah.
Like instruction cycles, like how long each instruction takes.
So how long each instruction takes?
Like, so load might take longer in terms of cycle than like add.
Okay, so one model is that I went to look at the instructions. And you already stepped ahead beyond this naive model. So a naive model is that I want to look at what instructions I'm running. So that one reason I want to understand hardware, understand performance, is that I can look at how many instructions I run and say, that's how fast my program is. And that's a naive model, and that used to actually be pretty good. It's very bad right now. So this naive model doesn't quite work because one instruction being approximately one time unit is rarely a good approximation, as we'll talk about later in the semester. Now, how many instructions you have does matter, and for some kinds of programs, that's actually pretty good, but for many, you need to know like what instructions are faster than the other. You need to know how the hardware works to know which instructions require data to move through lots of wires and therefore have the processor wait. Because knowing that sort of thing is going to tell you about whether your program is fast or slow. In particular, there's two big issues we're going to talk about in this class which affect program performance other than sort of instruction count, other than how many instructions you're running. And those are parallelism and caching. So parallelism, so who here has heard of parallelism? Hopefully everyone, good. So it's doing multiple things at the same time. And fast hardware is parallel. Hardware is inherently parallel, and fast hardware exposes this. It's going to do multiple operations from your program at the same time. We're going to talk about how we make hardware do that, because the processor you're going to implement is not just going to do one instruction at a time, it's actually going to do multiple instructions at a time. And if you want your program to run fast, you want the hardware to have multiple things to do at the same time. Otherwise, you're going to be missing a lot of your performance. Like on a modern processor, you're probably missing like a factor of 30 or 50 of your performance if your processor can only do one instruction at a time. On your simulated processor that you'll implement in this class, it's about 5. So this is a big thing. So understanding how to make sure the processor can do things in parallel, which means understanding what the hardware can do in parallel and what it can't, is going to be something you'll learn in this class, and that should be useful to you as a programmer to understand performance of your programs. Another big topic we're going to have is caching. So the way hardware works these days, accessing recently used things, recently used data, is faster. If your program doesn't reuse data or code, it will run a lot slower. And so I talked about not exploiting parallelism being in sort of in the worst case, like 30 to 50x slowdown. And that's really the worst case. Usually like your difference is like 2 to 5 maybe. But not exploiting caching, if you have a really unfriendly program for caching, one where you never access something that you recently accessed again, your slowdown is probably more like 1,000x. So that's very important for the performance, and it's something that you can do things about as a programmer, even in a high-level language. And so we're going to talk much later in the semester about how caching works in hardware, and also about how we can write programs to take advantage of that. Any questions about either of these topics? Parallelism, caching? So these are the two big things we'll cover in this course that deal with performance. I said here the number of instructions matters. We'll also be touching on ways of controlling how many instructions you have in your program, because that's also important, but it's not sort of as pervasive and as universal as these two issues of parallelism and caching, which you can anticipate will, you know, are things you can deal with at a high level and really affect your performance. So another thing we'll be talking a lot about is how compilers work and the rest of what we call a tool chain. So you have your compiler and you have also a linker. Who here has heard of linkers? Okay, so you've seen that before. Linker and all the things that are involved in taking your source code file and producing an executable. So we're going to help you understand what they do. And this should be helpful to you in the future, even if you never write a compiler or a linker. Because, if you want to understand what happens when compilers or linkers do something wrong, it's helpful to know what is the linker actually doing? What does a linker error mean? Why would I be getting it? What could be going wrong in the linker versus the compiler? So understanding how they work is going to help you. And it's also going to be helpful for debugging applications. If you want to know why your application is behaving weirdly and want to know why something's at this address in your debugger, knowing how the compiler and linker work is going to help you look at that debugging output and figure out, oh, this is because I have this in my source code. So this is useful knowledge to have. Knowledge, I think, as a working programmer, you would eventually come across a case where you care about it. So another thing that we're going to go into is we're going to talk about how hardware deals with strange things. So who here has had one of their programs segfault? Apparently everyone, because we don't teach you how to write bug-free code somehow. So we're going to talk about what a segmentation fault really is. So this should help you understand maybe, and how to better debug programs which might have segmentation faults, because knowing what's going on when you get a seg fault versus some other error. Talk about exactly how that mechanism works. And in the process of that, we're going to talk about how the operating system interacts with your programs. So the seg fault is the operating system getting a signal that your program did something it shouldn't have done and telling you this. So that's one way the operating system sort of controls your program. We're going to talk more generally about how the hardware gives the operating system mechanisms to control what programs do, of which seg faults are a part of that. And this will help you understand what happens when your program does things that the operating system needs to handle. So I think that will be useful to you even if you aren't writing OSs. And if you're writing OSs, it's absolutely essential to know, of course, what the hardware gives the OS to run programs. So any questions on these sorts of motivations for learning this hardware stuff? So if there's no questions on that, I'm going to move on to a more basic topic that's useful in this course. So I showed you all these sorts of this layers of abstraction, all these high-level, low-level stuff. But there's also some stuff which will come up in this course I want you to know. And one of them is powers of two. So we're going to deal with machine code, which is like in memory. We're going to deal with like amounts of memory, amounts of space, and powers of two come up all the time in that. And it would be really helpful for you to memorize powers of two. You don't need to do this, but I'm going to tell you it's really helpful to be able to quickly know the first 10 powers of two, memorize them, and to be able to construct, you know, that say 2 to the 15 is 32k. And a useful trick to notice here is that something k is 2 to the 1 something, because 2 to the 10 is about 1,000. Something m is 2 to the 2 something, because 2 to the 20th is about 1,000,000. And something g is 2 to the 3 something, because 2 to the 30 is about 1,000,000,000. So this lets you say, look at 2 to the 13th and quickly say, that's 2 to the 3rd times 2 to the 10, so that's 8k. And that's going to be useful later on because you'll do some calculations, you'll get 2 to the 15, you want to write that as something more readable or compare it to other numbers. And if you're spending your time figuring out that 2 to the 15 is 32,768, and somehow doing that without making an arithmetic error, which would be very surprising on a test, but possible, then you'll have spent a lot of time where if you memorize this pattern, be a lot easier. Also, I'll make a note here. So I've given k or ki. So sometimes you might see ki for kiba instead of kilo. This is for people who want to be very precise that they mean 2 to the 10 and not 10 to the 3rd. You might see that. We're probably just going to use k in this course. When we use k with a number of bits or bytes, unless we clearly specify otherwise, we mean a power of 2. We will clearly specify if we mean a power of 10. We generally won't. Most areas of computing mean a power of 2. There's one notable exception, and that's networking. In networking, sometimes they really mean a power of 10. So any questions about this? So if there's no questions, you should all be able to take these and convert them into something of the form, you know, some number k, m, g, t, whatever. Yes?
Are you asking for them?
Yeah, so first do them on paper, if you have paper, and compare your answers with your neighbors, and then we'll see how people do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want like exact numbers for these in the future, or just sort of like
the? Just the I'll mention that. Just the short version. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Absolutely not full numbers unless. Okay, so things seem to have quieted down, so I assume some portion of the class has answers. So let's start by the first one. Who wants to volunteer an answer and explanation? Back there. You? Yeah.
So because it starts, the exponent starts with a 3, you know that it's going to be 2 to the 5 times 2 to the 30.
Mm-hmm.
So 2 to the 30 is gigabytes.
Okay.
2 to the 5 is 32, so 32 gigabytes.
So, yes. So we do exactly that division. We take the first digit, that's an easy nomic, and that's the number part, so G in this case. And then we just need to know what 2 to the 5th is, which you could do the math and find it's 32. And I would recommend memorizing that just because it comes up so often that it will be actually useful to memorize, unlike almost everything else in this class. Okay. And answer for the second one? Yeah. 2m. So this is 2 to the 1 times 2 to the 20. So 2 to the 1 is 2. And that's 2 to the 20 is m for mega, so that's 2m. And I note that when we have tests and things, we will generally accept this sort of answer. We don't want you to actually write out a 10-digit number and get some of the digits wrong or miss a digit and have us have to mark your answer wrong. It's not worth anyone's time. So this is going to be absolutely acceptable if we ask what is the number of bytes on a test. So moving on, so 2 to the 9, that has nothing, that's one digit, so there's no number part. This is just something you would memorize as 512. It's not look up the SI symbol for 90. It's not going to help you. So, and then we have 2 to the 14. So we split this up as 2 to the 4 times 2 to the 10. 2 to the 10 is k. 2 to the 4 is 16. And that's going to give us 16k. So any questions on these? How you do these? Yes.
Do you know how far we have to go?
We will not get you above Terra. And if you write 1024G, that is going to be fine in any case. So you probably don't even need to go that high. Okay, so this is the forwards direction. And as you might guess from that being written on the slide, I also have the opposite exercise. So I do this, write it down, check with your neighbor that you agree on what the answer is.
Oh,
Okay, who has answers to all of these? Who has answers to some of these? Okay, so we at least have some. So let's start with 16G. Who wants to explain how they got their answer? Way in the back.
I got 2^34.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So you just take the G part, and that gets your first digit. So you can even skip all these intermediate steps. And then you just need to know what power of 2 is 16. And that's 2^4. So it's 2^34. So for 128K, that's going to be similar. We're going to say 128 is a power of 2 is times 2^10 for K. So the first digit is 10, and we just need to know that 128 is 2^7, which is something you can memorize or look up in the table a few slides back if you flip back slides. And so that gives us 2^17. So generally, the procedure here is going to be that you look at this number, you take this letter, and that's going to be the first digit of your exponent. And you take the power of 2 part, and that's going to be the rest. So it's a very easy thing to do, probably even in your head, once you memorize the powers of 2. So it means that converting to powers of 2, which is helpful for like doing arithmetic, like if we ask you to divide 4m by 2k, which often comes up, that sort of thing, later in the semester, that will be pretty easy. So 4m, it's 4 times 2^20, so 2^22, and for 256t, t is 2^40 for tera, and 256 is 2^8, so 2^48. Any questions on these? Okay, so that's our interlude into, you know, something we're probably not going to really test you on, except that this is going to come up later in the semester when you'll have to divide sizes by other sizes and things like that. Okay, so as I said, we're going to talk about this sort of hardware thing that most of this course is about. And the hardware we're going to be concerned about is processors and memory, basically. That's what a computer is, right? And is there anything I'm missing on this picture? Yeah. Well, anyone want to volunteer an example of what I'm missing? Way in the back? A hard drive? Yeah, so we have other devices on our computer. And somehow, our processor is probably connected to them. So we know our processor is connected to memory because our processor runs code and it uses memory. So our processor communicates with the memory. It sends some address to the memory and gets back some data. That's what our programs do, but we also like talk to a hard drive. So how does that actually work? And sort of a basic model for how this works, the part real hardware might be a little more convoluted than this, is that we change how this interface between the processor and memory works. That the processor is not going to actually be quite directly hooked up to memory, but there's going to be some piece of hardware, or some conceptual piece of hardware, might actually be part of the same physical piece of hardware as the processor, that we'll call an I/O bridge. So it's going to have the processor communicate to this bridge that's going to communicate on behalf of the processor to memory or to I/O devices. I didn't mention hard drives here because I wasn't thinking of that, but to all sorts of I/O devices. Hard drives are one example. Other common examples are like my keyboard, my mouse, my pointer, etc. And the model is going to be the same. So I've said that the way the processor would talk to memory in our simplified model is that the processor is going to send an address and then either send some data to the memory or get some data from the memory. And the model is going to be the same. So this is called a system bus. It's going to send some address and then send some data or get some data back. And sometimes, that's cut off. Sometimes it's going to send, say, a program counter, and it's going to get back, you know, some machine code stuff from the memory. That's one thing which could happen. And sometimes it's going to send an I/O request address, some special address that represents an I/O device, and the I/O device is going to send back, say, a keystroke. This is basically how the processor talks to memory and I/O devices, is that we have this sort of one bus and we send these addresses. Sometimes they represent data in memory. Sometimes they represent an I/O device to talk to. And somehow we get a response back. And that's intermediated by this I/O bridge component that just figures out who is this address for. Is it in memory or is it for an I/O device? And forwards the request on. So fundamentally, what our processor is it's just a machine that reads instructions from memory. So it sends out requests for an instruction, gets back something, and does an operation based on that, and then sends another request to memory, to the system bus. So all the processor does is load and store things from memory. It's just a machine for doing that, and we hope that the machine code we've given it makes it do useful things in the process of sending stuff to and from that system bus. But fundamentally, when you're building a processor, all you're going to be building is a machine that talks to, that sends the right things to memory. That's most of the work you're going to be doing. There's not other work to deal with I/O devices. It's just going to fall under that same abstraction. And, you know, and conceptually, the way we set this up is that we just set memory to the right value initially, and everything works the way we want. That the processor starts at some address, it reads that address, it does what it says, and that says to read another address, and it does what that says, and it just sort of chugs on from there just by talking to this system bus. So any questions about this sort of architecture here? So we're going to talk about how we build this processor here. And to do that, we need to talk about some of those hardware components. And some of you have had, I forget what the number of the class is, a class which actually deals with hardware components, and some of you haven't. It's a little awkward for us. So this may be a little review-y or not. And we'll go into this more later in the semester. But we're going to talk about, you know, how do the components in this processor work? So, you know, there are wires, and there's some sort of thing which does calculations, and we need to have some model for how those work. And I sort of gave our sort of ways we can think about that. And we could work sort of at the transistor level, at the gate level, and that's something we're going to know exists and generally not going to deal with in this class. We are not going to ask you how a transistor works, because we're going to build our processor from things that are built out of transistors, not from transistors themselves. We are going to talk about wires, so which I assume you've heard of in some context, and registers, and we might talk a little bit about gates. But we'll usually think about the logic that does calculations at a higher level. So to start out, let's talk about wires. So a wire, for our purposes, is going to hold, take a value, which is either 0 or 1, in the physical regime, this is a voltage, and it's going to send it from one place to another. So two things on the same wire always are going to have the same value, and that value is going to be 0 or 1. So we have this one binary value. And for most purposes, we're going to say that when you have a value on a wire, it's just that's the value of the whole wire. In reality, there's a little bit of a delay to do that. And this will come up a little bit in this class, but we're not going to actually do any real calculations of what wire delays look like. But it's important to know that it's physical. It's not the case that you change a wire at one end, and no matter how far apart the other end is, that changes immediately. There's going to be some delay. And it's very short, but we're dealing with things that are going to work on the order of nanoseconds. So even very short delays are going to matter to us. It's not going to affect how we build our hardware, but it's going to affect how our hardware performs. Okay. So another thing to note is that we have this sort of set of wires, and we're also going to talk about bundles of wires. So here, I have wires holding a whole bunch of values. And on a computer, we actually want to not deal with single bits at a time when we're designing our hardware. That's very inconvenient. If we have 64-bit registers, I do not want to write out what the add instruction does with handling each of the 128 bits that are input to the actual addition. That would be extremely inconvenient. So that's not what we're going to do. And part of not doing that is that we're going to abstract these wires, which we know individually only hold a single bit, into these bundles. So we can just say that instead of having this value 12 here, we're going to just bundle these wires together and just label it 12. And that says it holds the binary for 12 across a set of wires. So we have this bundle of wires. And usually, I'm not going to bother to draw 5 lines because that's really inconvenient to do all the time, especially if I'm hand drawing it. Instead, I'm just going to give a what line and label it 12. I'm going to say that we have a wire with the value 12. But that's not really what we have. Really what we have is this collection of wires running in parallel with the bit pattern for 12. But we're going to think of it as that we have 12 on a wire. And that's going to make it much easier for designing hardware, and that's sort of the level of abstraction we'll deal with in this class. We might have single bit wide wires, but usually we'll talk about multi-bit wires, even though we know that they're really a bunch of parallel wires. So any questions? Yes? Probably because I can't do math. Or I probably made a mistake when making the slide. Yes. It probably should be 0. Or this probably should be 0. I will correct that before I post these slides. So that's our sort of level of abstractions, that sometimes we'll have one-bit wires, but often we'll talk about bundles of wires as a single wire, just because when we talk about adding two numbers in hardware, we don't want to actually talk about doing it a bit at a time with all the extra logic. We're not going to deal with that level of abstraction. So some of you have probably seen gates before, so who knows what this is called? Couple people, anyone? This is an XOR gate. So we're not going to have you memorize the gates because these aren't going to come up very often. But this is a piece of logic. So, and usually represented by this symbol, it doesn't physically look like that. Looks very different. Yeah. Yes, it is. That should be that one. That's why. Okay. Shows parts of the slides that have been proofread and not. So this should be a one because we want to do all the possibilities, which is my intention. I typoed it in place. So this is supposed to be an XOR gate. That should be a one there. The idea of this logic, this is logic. So it takes in some values and outputs a value. So based on what the inputs and the wires are, it chooses an output. And conceptually, it does this basically instantaneously. You have an input on the wires, and the output will change as that input changes. And so we're going to have lots of sorts of logic that takes some input and produce some function of the output. This function is XOR, so it's supposed to, this is supposed to be a one, so this is supposed to take two values, and if exactly one of them is true, output true. And so this is something we can use to do actual calculations. And that's a lot of what our processor does. Our processor takes in that value from memory and does some calculation on it. That's conceptually all it does. That calculation is really complicated because we have all these sorts of instructions it can run and needs to figure out which one is part of that. But it's just a calculation. And we'll generalize this concept of gates to just say that we have a bunch of logic, that we can take some number, say 12, and put it into some logic and get a function of 12. We can choose whatever function we want as long as it's a deterministic function of 12. And when we talk about logic, we'll talk about logic that works in the same sort of way as gates, that it takes in a value on some wires and it outputs a value on some output wires, that is the result of a calculation. That is the function of that input. And that whenever we change the input, the output also changes. And there's going to be a delay with this, and usually we won't care about this, except for caring about performance. If you were designing real hardware, you might need to care about how long that delay actually is. We're generally not going to do that. But you should know that it's not going to be the case that instantaneously when we change this input, the output changes. But eventually, the output's going to settle on the result of this function. And we're going to commonly have pretty complicated pieces of logic in the sort of circuits we design, like something which adds two large numbers together, something that's not nearly as simple as a gate, something that we don't expect you to know how the real hardware would actually work beyond this sort of level of abstraction where you input some values and get a value out. That's a different class if you want to learn how to do that. Another thing to note about logic is that the input need not be the same width as the output. So this function here could be outputting some, a 1-bit value, could be outputting a 32-bit value, even if our input is, say, 5 bits. So any questions about the sort of concept of circuit logic? OK, so let's give a potential example of logic. Let's say I want to count from 1 to infinity. So here's my circuit for doing this. And let's say the wire initially contains 0, say a 3-bit 0. What's going to happen? Yeah.
It's going to have issues. It's going to not work.
So why not?
Because you're going to output the 0, but you're also going to be inputting it at the same time.
OK.
So it's going to have, if you did this in logic, so that's not going to be right. It doesn't take it.
OK.
It doesn't have that same thing at the same time.
OK. So you think that there's something wrong. The hardware can't handle the input being the output. Any other opinions? Yeah.
Yeah, you have an instruction, but you don't have the memory.
OK, so you're complaining that we don't have any memory. Well, the wire has a value on it. It stores a value. Yeah?
You don't have infinite bandwidth, basically. You don't have infinite space to hold information.
Well, OK, so we have a 3-bit number. So one thing which could happen, is that we could have this go to 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, and so on. Is that going to happen? So people think that that's not going to happen, that there's something broken. Yeah.
It's going to go 1, 1, 1, and then 0, 0, 0 is above or below.
Okay, so some people think that yeah, this might not be, that this will just go 0, 0, 1. This will overflow, but it will still count up. And
I think it's trying to hold two numbers at the same time.
Okay, and you think that there's two numbers at once, yeah?
There's no clock.
There's no, so you're complaining that there's no clock. We'll get to that later. That is a problem. So one model, one idea, the naive idea about what the circuit is supposed to do is that we can, you know, count up 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1. But as has been pointed out, this most certainly won't work. And it's just not stable. And there's multiple ways to think about this. So one thing to think about is what's going to happen when we translate, if we go from 0, 0, 1 to 0, 1, 0. When we're transferring, each wire of our wire bundle might change at slightly different times. So it's really hard to transition between those two values without having 0, 1, 1 or 0, 0, 0 on the wire very briefly, which is probably going to make this add one circuit do something funny with its output. So it's very unlikely to actually produce that result. That's one way of thinking about it. And there's some other problems that we have voltages, and we're going to have, when we go from 0 to 1, maybe 1 is 3 volts and 0 is 0 volts, there's going to be a halfway voltage in there, and the actual thing which detects zeros and ones in this piece of add one logic is going to have to choose some threshold, and it's very hard to predict what that actually works out to. So what happens when we're transitioning and we have 1.5 volts and the circuit expects 3 or 0. So this is going to be very hard to predict. So generally, the rule is that we will not ever build circuits like this. They won't work. Don't do them. So we never want to have this sort of instant feedback and expect to get a good result, this infinite feedback loop. So how do we build a counter? What do we need? We can clearly actually build a counter, so how do we do it? What do we need to add? Someone alluded to it earlier, that we were missing something. A clock, so that's one thing. There's another component besides a clock. Memory, that we need to have a place to store values that's better than a wire. So the logic is just performing calculations on the time. We sort of have values on wires, but they aren't really stored. So we're going to have extra elements to store values, and we'll talk more about how these work later in the course. Sort of the basic idea is that we add, say, a register. So a register is a component, usually notated by a symbol kind of like this, which stores a value and releases its stored value. And it's going to be, and when we add it, we're going to get the proper behavior of the circuit. That's going to go 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0. And the reason is that our register is going to buffer our circuit so that we don't have to worry about getting this intermediate result. Those intermediate values, is all we're always going to have when we're storing a value, we're always going to be inputting to this add one circuit the previous value, and it's going to be stable, it's not going to be changing. And to do this, the register is going to update based on the alluded to clock. So there's going to be a clock to tell the register when to read a value and start outputting a new value. And by only doing that at the clock, we can read a value that's stable and start outputting the new value to do the next calculation, the next addition of one. And this avoids those sort of transient values, and we'll talk a lot more about this later in the semester. This is sort of how we're going to build circuits, is we're going to take bunches of logic and bunches of things like registers and put them together. So any questions about this? Yeah. We will be building them in a hardware description language that we will talk about much more later, which will be basically writing code. We will not use a schematic capture tool like Logisim, which is a tool you draw circuits on. Yes?
Could you clarify the problem one more time? So
have to like, so whenever you get a, so when you're holding the, I guess, the value in your
So the problem is when a wire, in the wire case, when we transition from, say, this value to this value, we're going to have weird values in the middle. And the problem is that those weird values are going to produce weird output from this adder. That's going to go back in, and we're going to get more weird input. So with this register, we're still going to have that transition. But the register is not going to try to store the value, those weird values. It's only going to store when the clock says to, and that's going to be after the circuit has a stable input. So that's how we're avoiding that problem. Okay, so that's about circuits. So we're going to talk a lot more about circuits much later, but first we're going to do some higher level stuff in this class. Also like to talk briefly about sort of machine code level stuff and about memory. So machine code is that thing the processor reads from memory. And we should probably talk about what memory is. So who can tell me in like one sentence what is memory? Yeah. So a bunch of registers is one way of looking at it. So the abstraction we're going to use from this class is that it's a bunch of bytes. You can think of those as sort of registers that store values. And it's basically an array of bytes. And we have an address and a byte at that value. And so each byte is 8 bits. You should remember that. That's going to be very important in this class. Hopefully you've seen that number before. So one important thing that comes up with memory is endianness. So, here's some C code. Who can tell me what the output should be on, say, our lab machines? Or how I would figure out what the output is. So, okay, so one person, you have the idea that it has the value of 0. So that's a good idea, but that's a single byte. And how ints are 4 bytes. So what we're doing here is we're reading 4 bytes starting at this address. So the 4 bytes we're going to read are these 4 bytes. So if it was a char, it would be 0. But we're reading those 4 bytes. And we're somehow interpreting them as an integer. And we have 2 choices to do this. So one of these choices is called little endian, and one of them is called big endian. And in this course, we'll be using little endian all the time, because that's what x86 uses. So you've probably seen little versus big endian before. The question basically is, when we construct our full number, does the first byte, the lowest address, where does that go? With little endian, it goes in the least significant part. It matters the least. It's the littlest part of the number. With big endian, it goes in the most significant part. So in this course, we're going to use little endian. So the first part goes in the least significant part of the number. It's the first thing is where the ones place is. This any questions about this? So understand how to do this exercise. So you take those 4 bytes. And the first part goes at the end as we're writing it in our normal notation. It's the least significant part. It's the part which affects the value the least. So this is going to come up a lot. It's a constant source of confusion in this class all throughout the semester. I don't know there's a way of doing it. We have to choose one of them. There's problems with both. x86 has chosen little endian, so that's what we're always going to use unless we clearly state otherwise. And note that it matters here. We have endianness at all because we have multiple different addresses that we're combining into one number. If we had a 32-bit register, that wouldn't have endianness. It's a 32-bit value. It has a least significant and most significant byte already. We don't need to decide which is which. So we only have endianness when we have to combine multiple values into a bigger number, which we have to do with memory, because memory is an array of bytes, not an array of ints. So that's another common confusion. So registers don't have endianness. They just store a number. We don't have a name for the bits of that number besides saying it's least or most significant. So there's no endianness in a register unless you can somehow address the register as the byte 0, byte 1, which we can't do. So any questions about endianness? Yes.
So if you had like two 16-bit registers and you're combining it into a 32-bit register, would you flip it by bytes or by the two registers?
You would. So it depends what. So you're combining them into a 32-bit register. So it depends what result you want. The natural thing to do is if you want the one of them to be the high part of the new register and one of them to be low, you don't reorder anything conceptually. But that's not the level of abstraction you're going to deal with when you do that operation. Like if you do that on x86, you're going to move a value from a number from a 16-bit register to a 32-bit register. It's going to preserve that value. It's not going to ask you, how do I interpret the bytes? You're just going to say, I have a number that's less than 2 to the 16, and I want to put it in this register that can hold up to 2 to the 32. It's not going to ask you about what are you doing with the bytes. That doesn't come up. You're just taking a number. The only issue is when you have to interpret smaller things as a bigger number, in which case you have a choice about what order you take the smaller bits. So with those two registers, you have a choice about which one goes in the high part. And okay, so one last topic before we go, briefly. So, I'd like to talk about parallelism. So, parallelism and bottlenecks. So, something which we're going to do a lot of parallelism in this class, and an important concept to have is thinking about how much does parallelism speed things up. So, if we have something serial here, and we speed it up 5 times, we're going to make that part 5 times faster. And just a fundamental thing which comes up is that the other parts, these two serial parts at the end, become bottlenecks. So we've made most of our computation 5 times faster, and we haven't made our program 5 times faster. This is just sort of simple logic. If you work out what are the individual pieces, how long does it take? And you get these diminishing returns. We make it 10 times faster, well, that's not twice as fast. It's just the fact of life that when we have something we can speed up and it's not all of our computation, we're going to get these diminishing returns, and those other parts are really going to matter, really going to limit how much performance we can gain. And since we're dealing with parallelism in this course and hardware doing things in parallel, this is really going to matter. And this is commonly sort of talked about as Amdahl's law. The idea is that the benefit of the speed up here is limited by these non-sped up parts. So these red and green parts here limit our speed up. That as long as we aren't making them any faster, as long as we can't parallelize them or otherwise speed them up, they're going to limit our performance. And sort of the math way to look at it is that our time is our serial part plus our parallel part time divided by however much we speed it up. That serial part here becomes more and more significant the more work we do, and it really starts to matter. This is something we want you to be aware of, because when you look at speeding things up, this means that you're going to be playing whack-a-mole, that you speed up one part, and all of a sudden, that thing that didn't matter before really matters. Okay. So any questions about this before I move on to logistics? Yes.
Is it like serial part plus parallel part parallelism, or is it parallel part?
It depends what your units on your parallelism are. Here it's how many different things I'm doing in parallel. If I was talking in another way, it might be times, but yeah. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk about this course generally. So there's coursework. There's one important piece of coursework, which are quizzes. They are online. They are linked off the website. There's a tab on top labeled quizzes if you go to the course website, which is linked off CoLab. We also have labs. Labs are mostly graded on effort. Effort is going to basically mean, did you submit something which suggests you made reasonable progress on the lab? If you really, really worked hard in the lab and you submitted something which is basically the same as what you started with, I'm sorry, I'm not going to believe you because I have to set a line somewhere. We have homework assignments. For the most part, our homework assignments are going to have a lab which is going to introduce them. The homework assignment is going to be the continuation of the lab. So that's another reason to make effort in your lab, is that's going to solve your homework for you. And they're due at noon on the next lab day most of the time. We're also going to have a quiz exams. There's going to be two midterm exams and one final. They're multiple choice and short answer. They'll be in class except for the final, which obviously won't be. Probably we'll have a combined final. I will tell you about that when we get it scheduled. So more about quizzes. So we'll have a pre-quiz, which is going to be on the reading. So this is our textbook. The website will have readings in the textbook. You probably actually want to do them, at the least because we will quiz you on them, and that will be a part of your grade. They will be released by Saturday evening and due Tuesday at 10:30 a.m. before lecture. We also have a post-quiz on what we discussed in lecture for the week, which will release Thursday evenings, and due Saturday at midnight. The lowest 10% of quizzes will be dropped, so that's your, hopefully will deal with, you know, normal absences or life things. And the first quiz is tonight. Due Saturday. Probably won't count for much. We might drop it because of people adding dropping the class, but we want to make sure you can actually do them before it actually starts mattering. Okay, any questions about quizzes? Yes?
Are these quizzes open note, closed
note? They're online, they're open note, open book. No asking other people on IM for help, that sort of thing, please. Yeah.
Are the quizzes fine?
Yes. You will generally have 1.5 hours for the reading quizzes and 1 hour for the post quizzes. And if you have an accommodation, we should adjust your time. I'm not done yet. Thanks. Okay. So other topics. Attendance. I should mention this. Lectures are recommended but not required. They are recorded. The recordings will be posted. Labs are mostly electronic submission. You can usually submit remotely. There's one exception we will talk about when we get there. I'm not going to check whether you attend lab or lecture. I think it's a good idea, but I'm not going to check. Okay, other usual things. Since I'm out of time, this is your to-do list. Any questions about logistics before we go? Yes?
How are you going to do like the waitlist stuff?
I have yet to think about what I can do about the waitlist, if anything. We're limited by lab space to an extent, but probably we could add a few more. I'll have to see. Other logistics questions?
I don't know.